Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm Vice Chairman of the Club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org and view the online calendar of upcoming events. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today. Our programming tonight is Marketing is Broken, Influencers Can Fix It, with Nick Hayes. Let me tell you a little bit about Nick, then I'm going to introduce him. So Nick Hayes is a marketing pioneer, international business strategist, author, and speaker. His expertise in vision and influencer strategies has landed Hayes as an advisor to the Fortune 500. He's founder and president of Influencer 50, an influencer identification and engagement management company based in San Francisco and London, serving clients including IBM, Microsoft, Oracle, SAP, and Orange. His widely acclaimed book, Influencer Marketing, Who Really Influences Your Customers, has been described as a thought-provoking book that challenges the way we think and who we target, a must for any skilled marketer wishing to best his competitor. So it'll help me to introduce Nick Hayes.
Thank you. I appreciate so many of you coming out this evening. Now, first of all, can I just ask that if you're sitting next to somebody who you don't already know, that you just turn around and introduce yourself a second? Okay. Thank you. Now, it always amuses me in California when I talk and I ask people to introduce themselves, because I was speaking recently in Germany and I suggested that equally everybody in the room in Germany introduce themselves. And they turn around and, if lucky, they do. So it always seems to be about a two-second element of my talk. And generally, as happened tonight here, I think more people are more interested in talking to each other than probably following what we're going to talk about next. But what I would like to do is spend the next 45 minutes trying to get you to change your mind. Because in the talk that we're going on tonight, about marketing is broken and influencers can fix it, it requires a change from the way that most companies, certainly in the B2B and tech space, a change in how those companies market themselves. And what I would suggest is that those people the companies are currently marketing to are spending a lot of money, if essentially going to the wrong people. And the confusion is that those people were the right people only 4 or 5 years ago. But several changes have happened recently and over the past decade that has meant that the buying process for certainly B2B and also B2C prospects and customers has changed, and marketing departments have rarely caught up and followed those changes. So you may well be thinking that you're marketing yourselves to the right people. And what I want to do is hopefully explain how we believe that today they're not necessarily the ones that you need most to market yourself to. So if I can change your mind, then that's a good job done. Now, generally, vendors spend an enormous amount of their marketing budget going to certain types of audience. And I think that by the end of my talk today, hopefully I'll have persuaded you that the audiences that those companies should be going to are far broader, and in fact the ratio of spend is probably well out of kilter with how it should be. So, can I first of all just suggest that whether you want to write it down or just in your head, just think about who are your company's major influencers on your prospects and customers. So if you could only go to three people who not necessarily are going to buy your product or service, but you think would get the word around and be most persuasive, who do you think those three or four people might be? So just spend 30 seconds or so just thinking who those people might be. Okay, I'm not going to ask any of you who you've voted for, but what I'm going to try and do is, in 40 or so minutes, try and get you to change your mind on those people who you may have written down. So, we called the talk tonight Marketing is Broken, because if you look at what we call the insanity of marketing, and about how Einstein said, insanity was defined as doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And the importance of this point is that most of you, especially from the vendor side, and absolutely from the agency side, would have experienced a reduction in your marketing budgets over the past 9 months, year, 18 months. Very few people have more money to spend than they had a couple of years ago. When a company reduces its marketing spend by 10%, you can absolutely afford to do the same things you were doing, only you have to breathe in, you have to be a bit more efficient, but you can pretty much cover the same activities that you had when money was more available. Then you put in your budget cycle, and the word comes back you've got to cut it by 20%. And still, you're thinking, how do you breathe in that amount? But nevertheless, you probably try to engage in most of the areas that you were when you had 100% of your budget. Today, with the economy as it is in the B2B and tech space, it's quite likely that your budget will have been cut by more than 25 or 30%. And routinely, we're seeing companies and even some of the industry leaders being cut more than 50%. And what's clear is you can't even begin to map your marketing programs in the same way that you did on 50% of your budget as you did with 100. And so that's required a sea change in the way you even approach the audiences you go to and the messages you take with you. So, I'm sure I don't have to introduce Chris Anderson to any of you. But what he said was a quote here that effectively the mass market and the mass marketing technologies and methodologies are really not valid these days, and that the future is really based on the views of individuals. But clearly, the question that leads on from that is which individuals? And what I'm going to talk about tonight is very much how you identify those influential individuals, and why are they more influential than they were 3 or 4 years ago. So, that first point tells you the importance of influencers. Now, can you just put your hand up if your company typically has a sales value of greater than 20K? Maybe 50% of you. So you're not just trying to get to one or two people. For any business decision, there's at least 5 majorly influential people involved. And the higher up the scale you go, the more influencers take part. Now, have a look at some of these points. I won't read them out to you. Hopefully you can see them at the back. But the basic story is that everybody targets journalists. Pretty much everybody targets industry analysts. And yet only 9% think more broadly than the traditional sectors of journalists and analysts. If you look at the budget that most companies have for going out to these audiences, you'll find that it's so heavily skewed towards journalists. And I used to work with journalists quite a bit, and I'd see the amount of money that was being spent on just a few individuals and how I felt it was absolutely being wasted. And yet there were vast audiences that really needed to be marketed to who had very little spent on them, even if the company knew of their existence. So everybody targets journalists. And yet we've put here that only 50%, if that, of influencers are journalists or analysts. And working with my company in Europe and the US, we rarely ever even get to 50%. When we look at who really influences purchasing decision makers, I'm not convinced we've ever even had a 50% figure. So targeting journalists and analysts is fine if they are the majority of your influencers. And once they were, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they absolutely were the majority of your influencers in pretty much any B2B sector. Now, they're typically the 30, 40, possibly 50%. And what that means is that if you put most of your money into those audiences, you're now probably undervaluing over 50% of the individuals who are really impacting your decision makers. And the reason it's not been tracked is that influencers are difficult to identify. If you want to find a journalist, there are directories. If you track down individual journalists, they have business cards that say journalist. Similarly with industry analysts. I bet you none of us have ever seen anybody with a business card that says influencer. And what's more, many influencers will do anything they can to avoid being established as an influencer. And the other difficulty, which I'll come on to later, is that most influencers don't even know they're influencers. So what we have is that 50% of the most important people on your customers and prospects aren't currently identified. And that's something that most of my working time is spent trying to identify and understand how these people work. I think that bottom point about the other 50% are probably unknown to you. It's probably more than 50%. And very often we say to our clients that if they can guess more than 50% of the people we've identified, we will reimburse them for much of the work that we do. And they think that's a particularly good offer. They don't realize that we've never actually had to pay it out. So, let's just have a quick housekeeping slide about what actually makes an influencer. Everybody comfortable with that? Now, I'm not expecting everybody to read this, but this is a really important slide. Before you look at the figures, tell me, who thinks that in this down economy, a company's sales force has greater management power and greater impact and authority than ever before? Most of you think that the sales force have less or similar? Okay, well, all of our findings are that the sales force have far greater power than ever. They're listened to at sea level far more than they ever were. And what's interesting about this is that we have clients which were outlined earlier, some of the really big tech companies. And whenever we work for a client, one of the processes that we go through is we talk to the sales force and we conduct questionnaires and whatever. So as I say, individually, these points aren't particularly important. But we talk to over 400 salespeople to get this. And we ask them to rank the various marketing activities according to a scale of out of five. So that if you take four out of five and five out of five as being above average, you'll see that trade shows came to 34% thought it was above average. seminars, they thought 37%. So out of the 4 out of 5s and 5 out of 5s, the sales force generally ranked very few of them in that category. You look how heavy some of the people wrote 1 out of 5 and 2 out of 5. And I can tell you, without adding up all of those figures, that there's a heavy sway towards people who thought, who viewed marketing as less than satisfactory or possibly satisfactory than felt they were happy with it. So when you have two things, one you have generally considered to be sales forces having far greater impact on C-level executives and business decisions now, and the fact that they are extremely unimpressed by current marketing, it tells you that there's going to be a collision course. Regardless of which one of these you particularly favor yourselves, when you see that in terms of meeting the journalists, in terms of PR, 44% gave it 2 out of 5 or less. And that's a situation that we know can't go on as companies look to reduce their marketing budgets. They're listening more and more to the sales force. So we know that's got to change. The upshot of those figures I just showed you are those four key points. Now, if you link the fact that the sales forces have greater sway amongst management than ever before, and they have those four headline points, it reinforces not only that marketing in their eyes is broken, but that influencers are being totally ignored, even though the sales force appreciate their impact. So we often say that influencer marketing is one form of marketing that even the sales force like. And certainly when we go and talk to the major companies, we get quicker buy-in from the sales force than we do from marketing, because they appreciate that behind these business decisions and sales decisions that they're trying to persuade their prospects to make, there's a cloud of advisors that the sales force can't get to meet. That quite possibly the decision maker doesn't even know particularly exist. But if there's a form of marketing that can get to those people behind the business decision, then the sales force appreciate it. And we often have this anecdote where the sales force come out of a meeting, a salesperson comes out of a meeting and believes the deal's in the bag. Let's say it's a Wednesday, and it's such a good meeting, such a great lunch. They come back and they say, I'm convinced the guy's going to commit. And he expects to get the order. The Thursday goes past, the Friday goes past, the following Monday, and still no order. And within a week, the sales guy begins to hear stories that the decision's not going his way. And by the following week, the order's gone to a competitor. And the sales guy can't understand how that fantastic meeting when he was in the room with the prospect can have turned to a failure. And it's because that prospect, much as he might have liked the sales guy, went back, talked to his advisors, and came out to a different decision. And what working with the influencers is all about is trying to affect the views of that system of advisors, so that when the sales guy goes in, his point is being supported by the advisors and not contradicted. So, if you think that 28% believes that of the sales force believe that influencers are currently being identified, and 61% think that identifying the influencers is currently beyond the marketing department, it tells you that the marketing department really has to have and has to establish far more credibility in the eyes of the sales force. And that's largely what I'm going to be talking about this evening. So this is what we call the pressure wheel. And what it is Imagine your company is one of these around in the yellow outside band. And the pressure is coming from the outside in because you are one of a number of vendors in yellow. And you're trying to get, as are all of your rivals, to the guys in red. So you can swap any particular audience in there. We just listed industry, government, and education. But it can be any. It can be a job title. It can be a market sector or whatever. The problem is that the guys in red at the center, who you're trying to get to as a vendor, don't want to hear from you. How often do we all get fed up of being cold called by people trying to sell us something? And that's the same in business as it is in our personal lives. So the guys in red do not want to hear from the guys in yellow. The guys in yellow, it's their job to make sure that they're heard from the guys in red. So what happens is that the red inoculate themselves through the people in green in the middle. They create a barrier so that the guys in red don't have to listen to the people in yellow, who they know will say biased views. They allow themselves to listen to the guys in green. Now, we've identified, and just on this image here, just for the sake of clarity, we've put, 9 or 10 categories of green. But we've actually identified 24 different categories. And routinely, when we look at maybe the top 50 influencers in a particular market, those 50 influencers will come from between 15 and 18 different categories. And yet, maybe 80% of the money of a vendor is being spent on just 3 categories. So 3 of those categories, let's say, will effectively be having a lot of money spent on them. And the remaining 75% will be having next to nothing. And yet it's not just a case that that 75% are as important as the 3, they're probably more important. So what's happened, the guys in red don't like listening to the guys in yellow. The guys in yellow put all of their money generally through traditional media, maybe new media like bloggers and industry analysts, and they ignore all of the other ways in which the buyers get their information. And they largely ignore them because 10 years ago, not many of the people in green existed. And yet most marketing departments are set up in a way that was extremely relevant 10 or 15 years ago, and far less so now that we've moved into the 2000s. So, one more kind of theory graph here. If you look at this, there are various stages at which an influencer can influence a purchasing decision maker. So if you take a consumer purchase, let's imagine a pair of shoes. The distance between deciding that you might go out and buy a pair of shoes and deciding what to do and buying them, if you're a guy, it's probably 20 minutes. Less. I was being polite. So in 20 minutes, there's not much chance for you to have an array of influencers. I guarantee you guys don't go and phone up anybody when they see a pair of shoes in the shop they might buy. If you are buying enterprise software that's strategic or a government or regulatory purchase, that time span may well be 18 months, maybe longer. If you're in a business where your products or services are available and are being sold over, let's say, an 18-month period, there's a lot of different stages at which that decision can be influenced. And it's no good marketing to just this guy here, because by the time the decision is made, anything you said to this guy here has been totally forgotten. He's had his role in the decision. Similarly, you don't want to spend all your money targeting these people over here in the 11 months when these people need to have been influenced, because you'll never make it past the shortlist. So what we're trying to do is map some of these various influences onto the curve as to where they influence in the decision. And as I say, especially in the enterprise markets, there can be up to, we've listed here, 12 different types of influencer. And it gets more complicated than that, because we can't say that the trendsetters are journalists and the scopers are resellers and the recommenders are industry analysts, because all of these job titles might play one or more different roles in that. So you can see that just having a word with somebody because you think their view will make a decision go in your direction is far more fraught with difficulty than you might imagine, because they may be very influential, but they might have already had their say. Or it might be 9 months until they have their say. So what we're trying to do, and we're only at the early stages of this, is try and map when people are allowed to influence a decision to help us understand when companies should market to those individuals. We don't want to be too early in the process, and we don't want to be too late. Now, can I ask you if any of you come from a company where you think you've already pretty much thought through this process? I'm glad you're here tonight. So, let me make you feel better about that. Everybody who looks at some of the major companies that we work for looks at the list and says, well, you're okay, you work for those companies, they're bound to understand it. And we work with these big companies, and the first thing they say is, I know, we're worse than anybody else. And I have to say, they're not worse than anybody else, but they're certainly no better. And there are a few companies who have really gone through this process to a much greater degree than some of the others you might imagine. And if we get time at the end, I'll mention a few companies who are doing some work that, as far as we see it, are really taking the industry where it's going. Does this graph kind of make sense to you? Can you see it being applied to the kind of products and services that your companies sell? So, very quick, people say, what's new about influencers? They've always existed. Well, they have, but a few things have changed. One is that in business, very few solo decision makers or solo decisions are allowed to be made these days. Whether it's for regulatory reasons, whether it's for company policy, whether it's just about team collaboration, very rarely do any of us get to make individual decisions in business. Things have too many ramifications these days, and we have to fill in too much paperwork when deciding to buy something, to buy anything on a whim. Which is why we always like to include whatever it is, industry market research or something, to back up our decision. And there's a quote I like, which is was told to me once, that said, People use market analysis for the same reason that drunks use lampposts, not for the illumination that they're built for, but as something to lean up against. And I always felt that was appropriate, because we all know, and certainly I do it, that we buy things and we just find some stats that go in our direction, even if we don't even either believe them ourselves or whatever. We think it will help if we lean up against somebody else's stats. So the fact is that very few solo decisions are made these days. None of us are allowed to buy things in business on a whim. Whereas obviously in B2C, we can go and buy things without too many implications. Unless they're expensive cars where there's lots of implications. So something else that changed, the rise of decision maker ecosystems, which is this coterie of advisors, pretty much like the pressure wheel diagram I just showed, where different people influence different decisions at various stages. And sometimes they might, in a 10-month decision, an individual will influence that decision just once, in one meeting, in one phone call, for 10 minutes. Other times, an influencer will influence a decision repeatedly, day on day, for maybe a year. And you can all imagine that some people are responsible for scoping a product decision, and others will just whisper in the ear of the check signer at the 11th hour. And we're trying to understand when different people have different roles in the decision-making process. What has changed, and especially with the rise of the web, is our understanding about predicting and identifying these ecosystems. But what always amuses us is when people say, well, we know who's influential. We get all the market reach stats. We go on blog posts, or we go on Technorati to find out who are the most important bloggers. And how many of us have seen something come through the mail or the email or whatever recently where it said, find the most influential something or another? You know, I seem to get the most A's. And I just read down, and what they're measuring isn't influential at all. They might measure something with the largest reach or the largest circulation. Just because you have large circulation doesn't mean you're influential. And I always say that there's very little correlation between noisiness and influence. And if you take it back to your personal lives, you all know people who love giving their opinion, but you don't really listen to it. And the people's opinion that you do listen to, you have to go and ask and squeeze it out of them. But you know that when they say something, it's worth listening to. And that happens in business too. And some of the biggest companies in the world measure influencers simply on market reach. So, I wonder, when you were filling out your sheets or thinking in your heads at the beginning of this talk, and I asked you, think about your market influencers, I wonder if many of you managed to stay away from industry analysts or journalists. Can I ask you now, how many of you in your sort of three or four top influencers had at least one journalist in your head? How many had at least one industry analyst? In our past 3 years of working with B2B and tech companies, I would think 50% of our clients have got a journalist or an industry analyst in their top three or four influencers. No more than 50% have even got one. And it's very rare for a journalist to be the number one influencer. The one exception to that is Walt Mossberg, who, if you're in certain consumer tech sectors, is clearly the number one influencer. But it's very rare. It's very rare for an industry analyst to be the number one. And yet, I think most of you will agree that most of your marketing spend goes into targeting just very few of those individuals. I could probably suggest that at least 10 of those categories are untouched by most people's marketing budgets. So what I wanted to pretty much end the slide section of this talk is, people ask us about how do we prove the ROI of going to influencers. And I wish that we could say, leave us 3 months and we'll be able to track the increase in sales. Because, as you all know, everybody wants to measure quarterly impact by now. And we can't. We can't go back to our clients especially the larger clients, and say that we've generated a return on investment that could be measured through sales in the first quarter. But what I find most interesting is it's very difficult for me to ever sell on anybody in their 20s. Because most people have had to have maybe 10 years experience of working in and selling into prospects to understand and appreciate that marketing is not as ready-made textbook-based as we'd all like it to be. Conversely, the more senior a person, the shorter our conversation with them. Because I can guarantee you every CEO gets influencers. Every time we sit down and talk with a C-level exec, we never touch the explanation slides about the importance of an influencer. They just intrinsically know these people are in a cloud that they've never targeted before, and they need to. So it's interesting that this is one form where the more senior the level person, the easier it is to sell and persuade them of the importance of influencers. It's not even a conversation among salespeople. They totally know these people exist. And as we saw earlier, they know they're not being targeted by marketing. But what we're trying to do is we call it moving the needle. And that's all that C-level execs want and need to be persuaded of the power of influencer programs. They want to be persuaded that we can move the needle on those influencers. And by that, if we can track that when we started up getting a relationship with an influencer, they were somewhere, let's say, in this bottom left-hand corner, and if we can prove that we've moved them up towards that top right hand, then the senior execs will fund an ongoing program. They don't need to see an increase in sales over a short period, because this makes such intrinsic sense to them. And so when we're asked, how do you prove ROI of influencer programs, it's all to do with perception audits, where we go out to those influencers and ask them whether our clients are becoming more approachable, more favorable. Many of you will know about the Fred Reichheld, or one question you need to know, about the likelihood that you would recommend somebody else to buy or use that company's service. And that's effectively what we're measuring here. If we can help move the needle of influencers to become more approachable and more favorable, that's what they want to hear. So there's just a couple more minutes before I'm going to hand back for Q&A. But what I promised earlier is I said that I'd mention a couple of companies that are doing some really interesting work. And one of those companies is Intuit, who worldwide, Intuit are really seen as being one of the forerunners of what we're doing with influencer marketing. In that Intuit, more than I think pretty much any software company that I know, totally understand what it's like. Do you think this is the man from Intuit? Intuit totally understand what it's like to buy their product. Now, you all know, I'm sure, what it's like to be one of those responsible for selling your product. But I wonder how much time you've ever invested in putting yourself in the eyes and in the shoes of the prospect as to what it's like to buy from you. And number one, would you ever even find your company if you were a prospective buyer? And Intuit train all of their marketing staff to think what it's like to be a buyer of their products, not a seller. So they stand people in a retailer, watch for who's dithering as to which finance software program to buy, and then they metaphorically invite themselves into the home of that buyer to really understand what changed their mind on one product, how they open it, how they use it, when they felt that they nearly lost them as a prospect. Intuit pay a lot of money and have put a lot of effort into really understanding what it's like to be the buyer. When you look at somebody like Tesco's, one of the really big supermarket retailers, and they're coming over to the US and want to be the next Walmart. And they put 24 of their senior execs into a buddy program with families in California. These guys, the top 24 execs, seriously well paid, were buddying up with individual families over a 9-month period before opening up any retail stores in California, because they wanted to understand what makes somebody buy when they buy. It's not a coincidence that Tesco's is considered one of the top 3 go-getting companies in Europe when they put their most senior execs into buddying programs with their prospects. Another company that makes mobile handsets have said that they will never do a hard launch of a product again, because hard launches of their cell phones cost so much money and they can't afford to market a dud. So they won't risk having March the 29th as a launch day of a product that is then slated in the media and the analysts and the blogosphere and whatever else. So they will go out and identify who are the most influential people, and they will seed that product 4 or 5 months before launch with those people. Let's say it's this gentleman who I give a phone to, and I leave that phone with him for 2 weeks, and I give him a form. And my courier, after 2 weeks, comes and collects this gentleman's view of the phone, and it sends on to this gentleman, who can see this person's views on it. And he has it for 2 weeks. And it goes to 5 different people. So the 5th person sees 4 other persons' views of it. Then this phone company collects all the demo phones back in, analyzes all of the comments, decides what it's going to act on, and implements it for the final version. Now, that does 2 things. Takes out all of the rookie errors, like it shouldn't have had square corners, it should have had rounded corners. But also, it gets all of the influencers on board, who now have got no interest in slating the product when it's finally available, because they were part of the review program to start with. So when the Wall Street Journal or Mobile News or whatever it is then calls up various influencers for a comment, that comment is not only informed because they've already seen it, but it's far more likely to be positive. And we all know the power of word of mouth on launch day of things. And that's very much the way that we see the future of marketing launches, is that nothing will be hard launched. Products will be in a continual state of soft launch, because the risks of hard launching a dud are too great these days. And it's all to do with the way this company has understood the role of influencers. And that's pretty much my message today, is that traditionally, the influencers that we've been led to believe were the most important to our buyers are probably not so these days. And if I could help you to broaden out your understanding of who influences the buying decision makers, then that should stand everybody in better stead going forward. So, does that make sense? Great. Well, thank you for your time.
Sure. Okay, thank you, Nick. I'd like to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Marketing is Broken, Influencers Can Fix It, with Nick Hayes, CEO of Influencer 50. So we've got a lot of questions. I don't know if we'll be able to get to them all, but one question I had: how do you start? I mean, you told us a lot about the overarching theory, but do we have to pay you a lot of money for you to tell us exactly how to do it, or
that's a good question. How do you start is you put yourself in the shoes of a prospect and you get as far away from your company selling it as possible. So I was shocked that I spent, you know, 15 years in marketing departments, and rarely, if ever, I think, was I ever invited to sit down and talk with a salesperson as to what a prospect looked like. Certainly no salesperson ever invited the marketing department out to its prospects to see the coal face for itself. So what I'd say is take some serious time out from your marketing role and really analyze what it's like to be a buyer if you didn't know your company. And I talk to so many companies that say, we're pretty much convinced that everybody who buys already knows our company. We've just got to show we're better than the competition. And the fact is, most people who are buying don't know of that company. It's very easy to miss the number 4 or number 5 or even number 2 player in a market. So how do you start is you put yourself in the shoes of a prospective purchaser and work out whether you'd even come across your company, let alone decide to buy from it. And once you've done that, you can then work out where are the different points where you would either interact with a supplier or what third parties would influence you. And then you go and individually meet those influencers and work out whether they would put you off or turn you on to your company more. But it's very much how do you start is by understanding what it's like to be a buyer. And it's a lesson that I'd really advocate to any marketing department.
Thank you. The next question is, how do you measure the success of an influencer program?
I wish you could measure it with an increase in sales in a foreseeable period. But realistically, especially in the major companies, there are so many factors as to why sales are made and why quarters are good or bad, that nobody, whether you're advertising or PR or trade shows or whatever, virtually nobody can really quantify the benefit that your particular marketing activity had on sales. But as I say, the higher up you go in an organization, the less tangible you need to make your proposition. And the higher up you go, the less they believe that your programs implemented a 2% or 5% increase in sales. But C-level execs know totally that they need to get to influencers. And if we can prove the credibility of the influencers that we've identified, and then we work with them and prove that their views on the company are more popular and more favorable, then the execs have no issue with funding a program. Intrinsically, they know that that's what they should be doing. What they don't like is when they see marketing spending money on people and individuals and on activities that they just can't see why they would want to try and persuade a particular audience. And especially in these downtimes, we're seeing more and more people who are saying, why should we be spending money going to these people here? Whereas in the good times, the comment was, why aren't we going to everybody? Why aren't we going to more people? We know marketing people who are incentivized based on the number of impacts they have in a region, regardless of whether those individuals they're impacting are qualified or not. They just have to get out in front of 300,000 people. And it's this kind of ridiculous metric that we're trying to move away from. But if we can get Salesforce anecdotes that their sales were helped because we used the influencers to work into an account, and if we can have the backing of the chief execs or the C-level execs, the marketing absolutely believes that influencers are a core target that will get internal backing. And so that's how you start a program, and that's how you can prove the ROI.
Thank you. The next question is, discuss how to find internal thought leaders within a company, how to reach them, just how to find out who they are.
About 2 years ago, we had a major telecoms company come to us, and they had over 100,000 employees. And they wanted to brief us to come and identify who were the most influential 150 employees in their organization. Because they were bright enough to know that the 150 most influential were not the 150 most senior. And what they wanted was, they didn't care who were the senior people, they wanted to know who actually had the buy-in internally, who had the credibility, the charisma, or whatever. Now, we didn't work on that project because we accepted at the time we couldn't tell how influential internal employees were. We also think that there's a double-edged sword to that, which is because of the major layoffs that are going on, that we don't want to be identifying people who they then decide to keep at the expense of others. So how do you identify internal thought leaders? We believe that, number one, we don't have the methodology to do that. We have a pretty proven methodology for sales influencers and decision makers. Internal thought leaders, we don't. And we think it's a very tricky subject, a very controversial subject that currently we'd prefer to stay out of, because I think it can cut both ways.
Okay, thank you. Could it be that the journalists are not themselves the influencers, but are being used as the vehicle to talk to the perhaps unknown influencers out there in the field? It's sort of a tricky question there.
Yes, but the issue is that one of the issues that I have in many markets, journalists are extremely important. We're certainly not in any of our graphs trying to show that they're not. But I used to go into companies and try and sell them on the importance of journalists. And the difficulty was, it wasn't ever an issue to persuade a marketing VP or director that journalists were important. But try persuading a head of sales that journalists are important. And sometimes they just look at me and say, but none of my prospects or clients read any of those titles. How do you then say, well, fair enough, but I'm still going to tell you why we really have really good relations with them? And that really was the start of my understanding of influencers, was because I began to hear this more and more from the sales forces who believed the journalists weren't getting in front of their prospects. They believed their prospects weren't reading those titles that I thought they were. And so we began to look at, well, if most companies, most prospects don't read the media, where are they getting their influence from? And that was very much the start of our thinking. But it is possible that the journalists themselves aren't influential. But the fact is that in many markets, magazines are still very important. But they're nowhere near, we believe, as important as marketing departments believe and would like them to be. Marketing departments would love journalists to be important because journalists go around with a business card that says journalist, so they're easy to identify. We've all got a history of, in our industries, reading certain magazines. But the fact is, buyers today don't follow the historical importance of these magazines. And the real influencers are much harder to find than simply looking in a media directory.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to ask you one question here and combine one with my own interest here. In regards to your company's programs, what is the average volume of participants in a program? 5, 50, 500? How does size correspond to ROI or program cost? And I would add to that one, I know you probably can't talk in anything other than a general way, but What is the average budget for a company to hire your firm? Someone like you.
Okay. Can I just see the question again? In regards to companies' programs, what's the average budget? Right. What is the average volume of participants in a program? Right. I'm not sure I'm answering this, so whoever asked it, tell me if I've missed the point. I'm not trying to sell the services of our company now, so I'm going to keep it fairly generic. But we go out and identify the 50 most important individuals to a particular company or product line or service line. And the reason we choose 50 is that we believe 50 is broad enough to encompass the majority of your major influences. So just like I talked about the pressure wheel, if we only identify three people, they will be important, but they won't get to most of your market. And we believe the 50 will represent a pretty good span of influencer. The reason we don't do any more than 50 is we need to keep it a number that you can get your arms around. Because the last thing that I... One of the earlier questions was, how does a company start? Can I just say one thing that a company shouldn't do, which is add these influencers to every mailing list you've got in-house? Because the worst thing that I think ever happened to some individuals we identified was the number one individual asked to be taken off the client's mailing list 3 weeks after we'd identified them as number one. Because the word went round, this person's really important. And every country in the world then made them every offer and whatever else. And they alienated the number one most important person because everybody wanted a piece of this guy. So we aim for 50 because we think it's a broad enough number to represent a good span, no more than 50, because 50 is a number where you can get a one-to-one relationship with these people. If you choose 50, they really are very influential people. They're very important people. If you choose 500, they simply become a new database. And we can't afford these really important people to your prospects to become simply part of a database. So, in terms of volume of participants, when we eventually get down to a top 50 of a particular marketplace, if I read this right, we might start off if we're looking at a particular country for a product line, a typical country might start off with 600 what we call players. And players are simply people we've identified, but we're not sure how influential they are or not. Now, we recently did some work in India, and there were 1,300 players before we boiled it down to 50 influencers. In the same time frame, we did some work in Poland, and there was about just over 200. So typically, I'm not sure about the volume of participants question, but there will be several hundred, typically maybe 500, that we then ratify down in various stages to get to the 50 most important. But it's interesting to us that companies haven't worked with influencers because influencers don't buy from you. They're not probably in a database that the vendor has. They've never called up asking for a product demo. And so these people aren't known to the major vendors, but they sit behind the decisions that are massively influential. So the answer is we boil it down to 50, but we might start off with anywhere between the low hundreds to the low thousands.
Thank you. Did that
kind of answer it?
Yeah, that was pretty good. I think that will do. If you could afford to find out just three types of content, what three things are the most influencer-friendly, generally speaking?
Right, okay. The influencers love to feel that they're important. That's notwithstanding the fact that, as I say, some influencers don't want to be recognized because they believe that they're influential only because they're working under the radar. So one thing that you really have to work out with influencers is the batch of influencers that are influential because they're very high profile and everyone knows their name, compared to the batch of influencers who work under the radar and don't want to be identified. And you have to be very sensitive to working with those people because the last thing they want to feel is that they're being marketed to. Journalists love all the attention, by and large. Many categories hate any attention. It just gets in their way. So you have to be very sensitive about working with them. Just refresh my memory on the answer to the question.
It's if you could afford to put out just three types of content, What are three things that are the most influencer friendly?
Right. I'm not even going to suggest I know the answer to that. And the reason is I know the answer for specific clients. What I'd suggest is the way to find out is have a conversation with those influencers. Now, influencers like to feel important. And so whatever materials you have, what they really want is your time and attention. And if you... Flattery helps most of us. Who hates flattery? Exactly, none of us. So if you can go to the influencers and say, we've looked at the marketplace, we've spent a lot of time analyzing it, and we think you're really important as a result of the work we've done. What do you want? What do you do with your role? And how could we help you do it better? That person will then, number one, probably be flattered. Number two, be surprised. And number three, help you to tell you the things they don't want to hear and the things they do want to hear. So rather than me blanket say, well, people like podcasts or people like white papers or whatever, it depends. The 50 are individuals, and they may have 50 different ways that they want to work with you. So my answer is identify the people and then go and have a one-to-one conversation and ask them. And I think just in the fact that you're listening to them, you'll get much better traction with them than ever before. And the funny thing is that the most difficult thing about initially working with influencers is stop them being so skeptical as to why you're suddenly interested in them. And we had a client just last week who said to us, it was a great conversation once I'd persuaded the influencer that I wasn't trying to sell to him. So in terms of content, ask the influencer directly. And you'll, over the 50, you'll get some kind of commonality. But it's all about listening to them. It's not about selling to them.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm afraid we're at the time in the program where we've come to only one more question. After the program, we will be drawing some names. Nick will be drawing some names from your business cards to be giving away books. But we will conclude the program for the radio broadcast the normal way, and then we'll do the drawing. So, Nick, one last question for you. I hope you can answer it. What do you do when an influencer turns against you, your company, your brand, or your product? This is from Pablo.
Okay. That's a really good question, and we've got some recent experience that we've got a client with an unusual amount of people in this category. We would advocate, ignore them. You would have to spend so much time and money trying to appease these people who love being an antagonist of you. They get their kicks by being on the forums and blasting you or talking to their friends or whatever about you. That we actually say, ignore the worst 10%. It's really not worth your effort trying to turn these people round. The very worst of these people anyway. And absolutely, there are influencers who, number one, cannot be seen for business reasons to be getting into bed with you. The second, they even entertain a conversation with you, they believe they've either sold out or lost their credibility or whatever. So you just have to accept some people make their money by not being fans of yours. So, number one, ignore the worst 10%. Work for the 90% that you can move up that chain. And respect the people that, you know, dislike your company or product line because that's what makes them tick. Just don't get hung up about it.
Okay, well, thank you. So I'd like to remind our listening audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker tonight is Nick Hayes, CEO of Influencer 50. Our program is Marketing is Dead, Influencers Can Help. So with that, I would like to close this program and thank you for coming to the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 150 years of informed discourse.